inside the feral zone.
Greetings, listeners. Welcome back inside the feral zone. I am Renee Komen, operating in the glare of the day from an undisclosed location. Here we are, Sunday morning coming down. It's very unusual for the feral zone, but you know, you got to do what you got to do. So as those of you who have listened before, you know the Feral Zone is a sister podcast of the Troubled Men podcast. It appears in this space from time to time, certain special occasions, and this is certainly one of those special occasions. We're very honored today to have a couple of New York luminaries here amongst us. First of all, we have the illustrious singer, guitarist, songwriter. She's toured and recorded with John Cale. You may know her from her ethereal vocals on Only Time Will Tell. She's also sang with Tom Verlaine, performed with David Bowie at Carnegie Hall. She's also the door person at CBGB's, talent booker at Max's Kansas City. She's had formed Floor Kiss with D-Pop, also had Extra Virgin Mary with Paul Chapin. Her latest album is The Sad Electric Now. So without further ado, the great Ms. Dear France. Welcome, dear.
Hello.
and also sitting here with us is a terrific bass player, actor. He's played with Tav Falco's Panther Burns in the Panther Army, like myself, for many years on and off. He's appeared in a number of films, including Vortex and The Way It Is with Steve Buscemi and Vincent Gallo. Love that guy. He's now playing with Dear France. And without further ado, the great Mr. Kai Eric. Welcome, Kai.
Thank you very much for having me, Renee.
Yeah. So y'all are in town on this big like quadruple bill that they had at BJ's last night. And it was all bands that, several bands that are kind of Pantherburn, Alex Chilton related. One of those occasions where it brings all the people out of the woodwork. And last night we had actually some people that were in from Detroit, which I was surprised, had Mike Hurt. And I was like, man, Mike, I knew it's going to bring people in from the woodwork. I didn't think they'd be coming from as far as Detroit. But had him, had another fella who I've known this guy for a while, but I didn't realize until last night that he was George Reinecke's nephew. And George gave him his first guitar lessons many years ago when he was a kid. I had Lorette Velvet, who we did a podcast with yesterday, and Marquis de Coconut, who I guess Alex Chilton had produced a record of his band, the Lolitas. And you know, you guys, terrific. The Dear France set, when it was over, I told you this last night, I was like, man, y'all really got that downtown New York sound, man. You can't fake that. So you guys have been playing around. You did a few dates. You played a date in Memphis with the same lineup?
Yes, we played at DKDC.
Oh, yeah.
We happened to come to Memphis about 4 months ago. She was coming down for a memorial for her guitar player friend Sturgis, and
Sturgis Nikitas from Sturgis Low
Nikitas,
Society,
who played in Low Society, but also played in John Cale.
Okay,
with John Cale, and so they had a history. I just thought, oh, you're going to Memphis. I hadn't been in Memphis for a while, but I had a checkered past here or there as well.
Uh-huh.
And I thought I'd accompany her, and we went down, and I called up Ross Johnson.
Yes.
I said, we're coming down, and he said, oh, well, come playing over at the Lamplighter. Why don't you come and play a couple of songs? And we went over there. Well, that fell through at the last minute, but Lorette got us this gig at DKDC, which turned into a thing.
Yeah.
Turned into a happening.
Uh-huh.
We were only in town for four nights, but by night four, we were headlining at DKDC, and it was a sold-out show. Not that it takes a lot to sell it out, but
sure.
It's, It's a wonderful place in Memphis.
It's a fun room to play, man.
Yeah. And so suddenly we were invited back.
Okay.
You know, we made a little money to boot, you know.
Right on, right on. So you guys are living up in New York these days. You've been in New York for a long time. Well, let's go back a little bit. Dear France, tell me, where'd you grow up? Where'd you go to school?
I didn't go to school. I grew up in Manhattan.
Okay. Oh,
I was born in Manhattan.
All right. Yeah. Native New Yorker.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I didn't go to school. I was expelled 3 times, and I said, "Okay, you win." And
what part of town did you grow up in?
Washington Heights.
Okay.
Up by the Cloisters.
Uh huh.
So I did that till I was 12, and then I moved downtown. And
really,
yeah, I was like neighbors with Chris Stein in 71. We were both in that same building on First Street and First Avenue.
When you were 12?
No, I was 16 by then.
Oh, okay.
I moved around. In fact, the family I lived with came last night to the gig.
Really?
Yeah. It was beautiful. It was really beautiful.
Huh, and your family was not concerned about you living on your own from 12?
No.
Okay.
No. It's
different times.
No, they called my mother Ice Nine.
What does that mean?
It means she was cold.
Oh, okay.
Kurt Vonnegut, Ice Nine.
Oh, okay. Oh, right.
It was easy.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that must have been a real scene there, like the early 70s into the late 70s. So that's just when a lot of people, well, you were already there, but a lot of people were flocking from other parts of the country going there. I know, like, Jim Marshall, the Hound. He was on the show some time ago.
I worked at Max's. I was the girl downstairs who I used to give, like, Lou Reed and John Lennon their messages. And
so when did you start working at Max's?
73.
Wow.
73.
Wow, so that was a hotbed there.
It was great. Everybody was there. It was so cool.
Yeah.
Remember Dick Shawn from the Producers used to
his
dance, and Taylor Mead had that little round corner table by the jukebox, and it was very, very cool. But I started at CBGB's. I went and met Hilly, and he had a place, Hilly on 9th Street, and then he opened up CBGB's, and it was like a hootenanny, like lots of folk music and this and that. It was just a drag.
What year was that?
That was 73 also.
73, okay.
It was just terrible.
Yeah.
So I went over to Max's.
Oh, okay.
Because upstairs, you know, Captain Beefheart was playing, and, you know, Marley and Jeff Buckley and Suicide. I saw Suicide first at Max's.
Cool.
It was
love
great.
That band, yeah.
He scared the shit out of people.
Who, Alan Vega scared?
He had a big chain. And the tables are right there. Remember how low the stage was? Oh, it was fun.
Wow.
Really fun. And also the New York Dolls were playing at Club 82 around the corner.
Okay.
So I used to go see them. I saw them at the Mercer Arts Center. I saw them at Club 82 And back then, you know, back in the 60s, because I come from Manhattan, all the clubs were, no one had a liquor license. So you could go see anybody, anytime, any age.
So there wasn't an age limit.
I walked in, I saw everybody. I saw the Fugs. I saw the Mothers. I saw all kinds of, you know, because, you know, those people did not, you know, go into let's get a liquor license, because a lot of girls wearing long dresses drinking tea. It was easy.
Right, but I mean, they served liquor in those places, huh?
Not in the beginning, no.
Oh, did people
maybe
bring their own booze
kettle
or
of fish?
Or?
Maybe Kettle of Fish was a bar, but they were really the places that played music. You know, they were getting away with murder. You know, they.
Okay. Well, at Max's at that time, they still had...
Max's had the liquor license. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Mickey. Mickey knew how to do things right. And the bar was across the wall, and Joe Bird was the bartender, and it was a very happening scene. And the back room was all red with all the artwork, and you know, it was a scene. It was beautiful. It was beautiful, but I was...
In the back room, she was everybody's darling.
Did
they still have all the characters from Lou Reed's Walk on the Wild Side?
Yeah. Well, you know, by then, yeah, it was, you know, the residue of a lot of people that, you know, done themselves in by then. But the atmosphere was so fabulous. Like Donald Sutherland had a table. And, you know, you could just go there and just be ominous. You know, you would just sit there and like, no way. You know, it was the kind of place you just staked out your territory and you were your own scene. It was very cool. But I was oblivious. I didn't care. I was just floating above it all. I wasn't a scenester. I was too young to know. So it was good for me because I was just, you know, in it.
Right. Now, were you playing music at that?
I had been in San Francisco. I was one of those kids who went to Haight Street and had a band. And
what year was that?
Like 69.
No kidding.
70, yeah. And there was this radio station. They say, there's a party tonight, blah, blah, blah. And we get in our van and go to that party. And I had a top hat. And we would just play. And then put the hat around.
And you were like 15 or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, how did you get out there to San Francisco at such a young age?
I was working as a short order cook across the street from Columbia University, and the owner was a Greek guy, and my boyfriend had gone ahead of me because I had like a really bad accident. I missed it, so he just gave me plane fare. So I went out with $2 and a denim jacket and a tab of acid. And then, that's it.
And landed on Haight Street?
Yeah, it was really good.
Yeah.
It was really good. I got the tail end of it, of the magic, you know. It was before speed took over.
Right, right. Still had like Janis Joplin living out there.
Yeah, I was her neighbor at one point. I used to take out her garbage and I would go see her and I never paid for a concert. And one day she jumped off the stage and she gave me a big tongue kiss and it was just wonderful. I'm not kidding.
I believe you. No.
And then everybody like went off into the woods, you know.
Oh, okay.
We all thought we were winning the war and we were going to get rid of Nixon. And so everyone eventually started going up into the woods. Peter Coyote, you ever read his book? It's a fantastic book about that time.
Okay.
Great.
So you were like going into the commune scene or
no,
something?
No, they did. You know, okay. I came back to New York and...
So you're a city girl, right? You're
like, I am a city girl.
You're like me. The woods makes me nervous.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I was the first girl usher at the Academy of Music. So I came back, met an artist, and moved to First Street, First Avenue, and started, you know, working the Academy of Music. And then we go over to, Fillmore East? Mm-hmm. Upstairs, there was this place called the Throne Room, where all the acts would be upstairs. And again, oblivious.
Yeah.
I don't even know how good I have it. And I'm up there like, oh, hanging out with Jack Cassidy and all this.
Nice, nice.
Yeah, it was great. It was great.
So you had a band out in San Francisco?
Yeah, I had a band. The leader of the band was Richie Rich, and he was a man who dressed as a woman with a blonde wig and a dress, and I again oblivious. So he always booked us in gay clubs, and in the middle of a song, you know, I was the girl with the tambourine.
Uh-huh.
I wrote the songs, but I didn't talk. I took a vow of silence. So I did. So, but he would be gone for a while, and he'd be in the men's room, and I again didn't know, and then he'd come back out. Yeah, and I got an education through osmosis, you know. Just by being there.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Now when you say you'd taken a vow of silence, I mean, was that a 24-hour-a-day
yeah,
vow?
Yeah, I did not talk. I wrote a lot. I did not talk.
Oh, what was the impetus for that?
Do you hear the way I talk?
But you seem like somebody who likes to talk.
I do, but yeah, I sing better than I talk, yeah. And you know, too much.
So how long did you maintain that for?
I would do that for like a year at a time.
A year at a time? You
yeah,
wouldn't
yeah.
talk to anybody?
No, nobody.
That's crazy.
But I have like, I have auras that come off me, like aromas. So people could just smell me and go, oh, she's okay. You know, like... It's true.
You still engage in these periodic...
Yes, if you're lucky, I shut up. If you're lucky.
Well, hopefully that won't happen during this podcast.
Okay.
We'd be in trouble.
He's very able over here.
Okay. But wow, that's so interesting. So you do that for a year, and then you just decide...
Talk again. I did. What happened? I was working at Academy of Music, and somebody said, you know, put some lines on. We had a break. And remember that bar across the street on 14th Street, the old men's bar? what was it called? Right across the street from, well, it then became the Palladium, but it used to be the Academy of Music. There was this old Irish bar across the street.
Like
so they put some lines
Stone
on. Can I talk like this? Anyway,
yeah,
so we did it.
Say whatever.
And it wasn't what I thought it was. It was MDMD or something. And I go in there, and my boyfriend, I was 18, he was 36, and he had really long, long, long hair. And all of a sudden, he was Gandalf. And I was like, who are you? And that's when I started talking again. I couldn't believe it. I mean, it was... Such an experience.
The stimulants brought you out of the...
There was no way I could not ask. What the...
Right.
And then we had to go back, and I think it was Jake Isles or something was playing, and they were like, loud, you know, loud. I mean, the Academy of Music had a fantastic sound system, you know.
Okay, so you're seeing all these bands, the Dolls, all these people, and are you... When you get back to New York at this point, you're starting to find people to play music with?
No. When I came back from that, I didn't. I was always I was the girl in Central Park singing with everybody. And then I met this guy from Berklee School of Music. He was very cool. So he went down and saw Hilly. And Hilly was the first person that Hilly managed. And he was a very cool guy. So I was the first waitress that Hilly hired, because me and my friends... We were the background singers, so he hired him. He hired us, and he was like a singer-songwriter, you know. But then he got into drugs, and he ripped Hilly off, and Hilly never managed the band again for like you know, almost a decade, because he was burnt, by this guy. So sadly. So then I felt bad. So that's when I went over to Max's, and it was also really It was like laughing with sandals. You know, CBGB's was just like, it wasn't good. But when I came back, it was fabulous, because Vince Scalzo had this radio show, and I had heard, I had gone to see Patty at the Bottom Line, and Piss Factory was in the jukebox, but then Vince Scalzo played Little Johnny Jewel.
Okay.
Which is where I get the name from my band, Floor Kisses. That's from the song, you know, Tom Verlaine goes, JJ do the floor kiss.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so that's where that song, the name comes from, yeah.
Well, so you start working back at CBGB.
Yeah, because I worked at Punk Magazine with John Holmstrom and Legs McNeil.
Uh-huh.
But I had to walk, I lived on St. Mark's. I had to walk to 30th Street and 10th Avenue. No money, no heat, no food. And then Roberta Bailey was the photographer, and she felt bad for me. And she goes, well, you know, you could work the door at CB's. It's $10 a night. And I was like, because my rent was $50. So,
yeah.
So I just would walk down to CB's, and Hilly was just a wonderful human. And so
this is like 75, 76?
Yeah, 75.
75, okay.
75,
Well, I read somewhere that, so did you start booking bands at CB's at some point?
No, not at CB's. I went to Europe with Television in 77. And when I came back, Peter Crowley was going on tour with Wayne County. And he asked Terry York to come take over. And Terry York was more of a bon vivant, not like someone who would go to a job. So I went and did the booking. And he would come in and, you know, see what cute boys were there. And a wonderful human, wonderful human. So I started booking when I came back from Europe with Television.
Well, how did you wind up going to Europe with Television?
Well, Freddie lived with me, and you
okay.
know, I was
part of the entourage.
Yeah, I was
part
Mary
of
the K. I was
okay.
I was the fifth television.
Oh, cool.
You know, I cut their hair and dressed them and got the photo shoots and, you know,
very cool.
Did the sound and yeah. And also Peter Gabriel came, and he's like, oh, I think I want to they should open. So we go there. I never once left the backstage to see what Peter Gabriel was up to.
Yeah.
I was such a downtown snob. I was like, Peter Gabriel, get the fuck out of here. You know, I did it.
Sure.
But we saw, you know, all the other bands that were happening. And, you know, it was early. But
so what kind of bands were playing at that
time? I saw Susie.
Okay.
But I did not see the Sex Pistols. They weren't around. But the Heartbreakers were over there with us. Ramones were there with us. The Talking Heads were there with us. Blondie was there. So it was mostly us there. There wasn't really too much of a scene going on.
Okay.
But we went to all the clubs. The clubs were there, but the bands weren't there. But shortly after we got back, before they went back over again, there was an explosion. Like, the Clash weren't there. They weren't there yet.
Right, right, right.
They were all in the audience.
Gotcha. So I read somewhere that you were like the first person to hire the B-52s and Devo in New York City.
Oh, yeah, I did that. Well, when I got to Max's, there was a box. Like, when I worked at High Times Magazine, and there was a box also. And I found, like, you know, envelopes with checks from like 4 years ago. And so I sent everyone the books. I said, they were like, what are you doing? I wasn't even aware that checks expire. I was like, this person asked for a book 4 years ago. I was just mailing everything out.
Okay.
So when I got to Max's, there's a box of cassettes. So I just started listening to them. And I heard this band. I'm like, oh my God. So Richard Lloyd was living with Terry York. So Richard Lloyd and I and Terry drove down to Georgia, found the band.
The B-52s.
Yeah.
Wow.
And in Lloyd's book, he says it was just him and Terry. That's not true. It was me, him, and I. So we go down there. There were these guys called the Two Hats. There was these people who, like, Terry got to finance projects. They helped put out a lot of the records he put out. Terry put out a lot of singles for bands.
Mm-hmm.
Orc Records. So we go down there, and I'll tell you what, that band was, I went and stayed with Kate. She had a log cabin in the woods, and Ricky would go out there and talk to the cows, and they'd come around a circle, and she had one room just for her costumes. I can't even tell you, it's like where Dolly Parton grew up. It was like a cold water shack, but then there's a whole room of crinolines and satin and sequins.
Yeah.
And then we just sat, you know, just talked and just the greatest band. So I brought them up, and because I was booking, I would put them like, you know, 3-4 nights in a row. I did the same thing with Devo. It's like, it was a long trip.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And, you know, I put them up and they'd play, and I call up everyone, you got to see this band. Because they were doing art and color. You know, New York in 77, 78, well, black, you know, it's, you know,
right.
Until all people are free, we'll wear black. But these people were not there. They were, and Devo, the same thing. So, and Brian Eno used to sit at my bar upstairs, and every night he'd go, what's on the menu tonight, dear friends? And I'd say, oh, you got to see this. So I turned him on to the new No Wave. You know, I'd say, okay. Oh, you got to come Thursday. And I'd have Lydia and DNA and Mars and Come On and, you know, Otto Lindsay, all these bands. And he would just, you know, take notes and, you know, put records out. So I was only there for like a year and a half, 2 years before, you know, John Cale called me up. So, but we had so much fun. And then Devo came, and I could not even believe Devo. So I said, you got to come see Devo. And then Eno got David Bowie to come down, and they went back. And, you know, again, histories.
Right.
Made. But there were people interested. Now, you know, it's, I don't know. We just been traveling around the country, and we see all these bands. Like, what was that band? What was that girl? Susie, what was the girl with the cream cheese? What was her name? The band in Tucson at the Rock Club. There's like all these like really fun, great bands. And,
that y'all are seeing nowadays.
And you don't see the writers or the press. Like down at CB's, there was just half the room was always press.
Oh, yeah.
Smart guys.
Looking for something new,
yes.
Looking for what's
Dolly
what's on the
Creamer.
Dolly Creamer.
Oh, she was very good.
Somebody you saw recently.
Yeah.
Okay.
But actually, there was nobody writing about it. There was nothing put in the paper. Like back in the day, it was just like there was newspapers, there was fanzines, there was, you know.
Right.
Wait a minute. What station were we listening to?
We were listening to...
There was a cool radio station
WWOZ
last night.
It
was WTO...
WTUL?
Yeah.
And well, she listed, like, all these clubs, and it sounded like all these cool bands. And I was like, wow, I wish we could go see some of these bands.
Well, that's Tulane student college radio, so and that is an excellent station. That's,
right.
It sounded like the town was happening.
So you're mentioning meeting John Cale and starting to work with him. How did that happen? So were you playing in bands, or how did he know to hire you?
Do you know who Jane Friedman is?
I know that name.
Okay, so she was... Jane Friedman had a company called Wartoke, and she was actually one of the women behind Woodstock. She doesn't get any credit. There's always those two guys on the motorcycles, but she was there too. She was Patty's manager.
Okay.
And she was John Cale's manager, and she was Television's manager. So when I went over to Europe with Television, I was with her. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we worked together. We did everything together. And you know, I was the girl who say, that guitar's out of tune. Yeah. And run up on stage. And she promoted women. Uh-huh. She was very cool. Jane Freeman still is. She has two great art galleries in New York City.
Oh, nice.
So anyway, while I was in Europe, she was with John. They were together. Mm-hmm. But John was like, it's a piece of work. So it was my job to take care of him. So, you know, she would say, you know, go follow John, take care of him, don't let him get him too drunk. And at the time, he had like a pickup band. It was a bunch of little punkettes, little punk boys,
uh-huh.
You know. And he was like during the Hawaiian shirt phase, you know, he was okay. And he had all these little kids with him. So I had to stay with him and bring him back. And that was before cell phones or anything like that. So that was my gig, to take care of him. So when we got... When we got back to New York, she had another tour for him, and she thought, who would be more perfect to take care of John than me? So I wound up on tour.
Okay, and but not just as like a tour manager,
no,
but you're also
the
in
singer.
The band.
No, I was the singer, playing percussion and drums, and he wrote a song for me, and I wrote a song after something that happened, and I was with him. I did the Sabotage record, and
yeah, and man, that only time will tell. You know, that's one that'll live forever, man. That's amazing.
Yeah, he wrote that. He's a wonderful writer.
Yes, yeah.
I loved being in it, but prior to being in his band, he had been playing CBGB 74, 75, 76. I went to every show.
Mm-hmm.
I would just sit at his feet. I find him mesmerizing. So yeah. by the time I got to play with him, it was just so wonderful because he never left the room without complete anarchy. He was really into that. And it was also during the Iran-Contra thing. So we were always, you know, playing off. He always had a towel over his eye. What day is it today, dear friends? It's day 77. You know, like it was a crazy time. And also, we were traveling around the country right after the Vietnam War. So there was, the vets loved him. And in the front row, there'd always be like people in wheelchairs and people cutting themselves and drinking radiator fluid and like crazy people really dug him. So the crowd would be like, wow. And then backstage would be even more fun. And so, you know, you got to really experience, he was singing about war and he was singing about, you know, chaos, but the country was, I don't think people realize how crazy the late 70s were. Like, the war was over, 74, hooray. But it was scattered with Vietnam vets, and the government was just mailing these guys mountains of drugs. And my friend had a tendency to enjoy mountains of... So I was the girl in the band. He'd go, dear France, go find some... And I was sent out. And
to go score?
Find some guy.
Okay.
And he said, God, I just want to make it. And hey, and then he'd take me. And then, you know, about an hour later, there's Dear Franz in there. And then he'd walk in and charm everyone. And pretty soon that mountain would be gone and we could be to the next town. That's really what happened for 2 years.
Holy
you know, but because of that, we got to really experience the devastation of, when a government is... You know, lost its mind like it is right now. So, you know, it's something should be done, you know.
Right. We'll see. Something will happen.
Well, I hope so.
well, during all this time, do you cross paths with Alex Chilton?
Oh, yeah. I was Alex Chilton's sound man. You want to hear my Alex Chilton story? Okay.
Absolutely. Well, you know, Alex, that's who I started playing with when I was like, 19 years old. And that was my escape from music school. I was here at Loyola Music School, and after a couple of years, I thought, you know, I used to really love the way that I played, and now I hate the way that I'm playing, and I have to stop and figure out how I can get back to that. And at that time, I'd met Alex, and we started hanging around and playing together, and then I wound up, he brought me into the Panther Burns, and then he and I, you know, wound up playing in his trio when he did the Feudalist Hearts and all that stuff. I was in
those
bands.
And Chris Stamey, were you?
I was
after him or before him?
Yeah, yeah. So this is after Alex moved to New Orleans, in 83. Yeah. So that was later on. But I'm saying, so go on, tell your Alex show.
Okay, so the Ramones had played CBGBs, and we went to Eileen Polk's house. Eileen Polk was like an heiress, and she had a townhouse, and she had one of those round couches. So we're sitting there, and Dee Dee's going on about his favorite comic strip or something, and all of a sudden I hear, "Help me," like the fly, you know? Uh-huh. So I'm looking around, I don't see anyone. It's like, "Help me." So I turn around, there's this like person in a fetal position on the floor behind the couch. And I'm like, "Baby, are you okay?" And he goes, "Can you get me out of here?" Like in this little baby voice. And I'm like, "Okay." So I had one room on St. Mark's. I didn't have a kitchen, refrigerator, running water. I didn't eat nothing. So I take him there. And he stayed there until he recovered. And he was a mess. He was like, you know, just a mess. So
in what sense?
In my infinite wisdom.
Psychedelics or something?
I think all the Manson stuff, and people fucked with his head. He was young, you know?
Sure.
And he had that big mind, so he was always open to suggestion to think about things, and then he'd really rethink them. And
rumination, yeah.
So anyway, I said, you know what you should do? You should go down to Coney Island, and you should get on the Cyclone in the front seat and don't hold on. And he goes, okay. So he did that. And then he comes back to my house a few hours later, and his eyes are like, and then he started playing music again.
Okay.
Like it shook the cobwebs out.
Interesting.
You know? And so then I became a sound man, because he was always really cool with women. So I did his sound and, you know, other things. And
all right, so you were around when he's meeting the Cramps and
I was there for that. All of that.
So you saw the Cramps play early on, all those?
Yeah, the first show.
Right, okay. So you must have known Miriam Lena.
Just playing her new record today. Her new record today is fantastic.
Very cool. Yeah, Miriam's doing incredible work up there.
Kicks Norton
Magazine.
Records.
Yeah,
keeping it going after Billy passed away.
Right.
Yeah, I think she might do a tour.
Oh, man, that'd be great to see her down here. Well, let's take a little break right now. We'll come back. We'll get Kai in here. And so everybody out in the Feral Zone, go get yourself another cocktail, and we'll be right back.
Thank you.
back in the Feral Zone. I am Renee Komen, sitting here with our guests, Dear France and Kai Eric. Now, I know you guys are new to the podcast, but I will remind our listeners that this is a listener-sponsored, listener-supported operation. To that end, we have the Venmo and PayPal links right there in the show notes of every show. You can support the podcast, buy us a few cocktails, buy some notebooks. We also have the Patreon page. It takes all the guesswork out of supporting the podcast. Also, the links to the Troublemen podcast t-shirts right there in the show notes. And I'll remind you to follow us on social media, Instagram, Facebook. Also, rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast wherever you're listening to it. Give us 5 stars. Cost you nothing. Helps us a lot. All right, enough of that. Back to our guest, the great Ms. Dear France and fantastic Kai Eric. Now, Kai, so you and I first met. I was playing bass in the Panther Burns, and then Alex and I kind of started doing a bunch of solo or, you know, Alex trio dates, and you came in. We're playing bass with the Panther Burns. Now, how did you first come into the Panther sphere? How did you first meet Tav?
Well, first of all, when I followed you, I had some mighty big shoes to fill, and I mean you're the standard bearer.
Well,
I was kind of an actor. I had a leather jacket and I had a Fender bass.
You looked cool,
and I could just kind of play the three notes, and I was getting away with it. But I was more like a performance artist and more interested in acting. But I loved being on stage,
right?
And
well, let's go back a little bit. How did you get to where were you born? Where did you hail from?
I was born in the shadow of the United Nations building.
Oh, okay. So you're a native New Yorker as well.
Yeah, I'm a native New Yorker. I'm the first American born in my family. My mother was from El Salvador.
Okay.
And my father was from Denmark. And they both worked at the United Nations, and they met there, and they conceived me there. Right on the dais of the General Assembly. No.
But, that's an image.
But I remember I used to go, you know, my father would take me. I'm the oldest of 4 children.
Mm-hmm.
And so my father would take me to work with him sometimes when that was a thing, you know, to, right. Like I'd be 10 years old. My mother would have something. They'd put me up in a little blazer and a little bow tie, and I'd go and wander through the United Nations in the halls that are not open to the public.
Uh-huh.
And through the gardens where they had, like, the gift from India and Pakistan. There were, like, 8 wild peacocks wandering around. Bloom, 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 you know. And I'd go and have lunch with my father in the delegates' dining room. And it was very interesting.
Now, were they still working for their home countries? Or?
No, my father was, like, an international civil servant.
Oh, okay.
He came over as a statistician. Just when they just built the new headquarters. It used to be in Geneva.
Okay.
And they built a new UN headquarters in Manhattan. And so they were populating it with, like, international civil servants. So they were trying to bring in people from different countries.
Uh-huh.
My father was a statistician. He came over and he worked there all his life. He was a career. He became like a P4, which is about the highest level you could get up there.
Uh-huh.
Interestingly enough, he was one of the 12, because he'd go to the bulletin board and like, oh, they got a special assignment here. And he was one of the 12 peacekeepers, initial peacekeepers in the Egyptian Israeli conflict.
Oh, in the Sinai.
So he went there and was standing in one of those towers getting shot at from both sides. And so
when you're a little kid roaming around on your own, did like all the people working at the UN kind of know you? It's like, oh yeah, that's Kai.
Well, my parents had remember like the 60s and the 50s was the age of the classic cocktail party, you know, the women, you know, the moms had ponytails and they wore the pleated skirts and
right.
and the cashmere sweaterettes And they would give these cocktail parties in a suburban neighborhood. And all of these limousines would pull up, and these black, and I'm talking about really black from, you know, Burundi and Uganda, black, you know, ambassadors would get out and come in. Boy, would they drink.
Yeah.
They would drink and drink and drink, and they would party. But it was just a little suburban house, you know. And, yeah, so that was it. I just never knew what to tell my friends. It was very hard to describe what my dad did for a living.
Sure.
You know?
Even if you described it, it wouldn't have made any sense to them anyway. They had no frame of reference.
So I would go out to the playground and say, well, my dad's a fireman, and my dad's a policeman, and my dad's a doctor, and my dad's a lawyer, and my dad works for the United Nations as a international civil servant. You know, so it was kind of vague to me, but I think some of the idea of the UN kind of made me the progressive that I am today.
Okay. Well, so you get into theater or something? How do you?
From high school, I was as a teenager, I was incredibly nervous, dysfunctional, quiet, and incredibly shy, and I hated the idea of speaking in public. And in like 11th grade, I had this assignment where I was supposed to go and speak in front of the class, prepare something, and I was not going to do it. Mm-hmm. Adamant. I just decided I'll take the F.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna. I was so terrified to get up in front of people and speak. But at the last minute, in a truly deluded, I don't know what got into my head, I thought I could go up and improvise something and maybe get a D, you know? So I got up, my hair, by the way, at that time was down to my shoulders. I had like shag. I was wearing probably purple bell bottoms. I was one of the few hippies in the school of 1200, right? And, you know?
This is in Manhattan.
No. This was, by this time, my parents had bought a house up in Rockland County, which is about 20 miles.
Okay.
You know, it was a suburb, one of the new suburbs. I got up in front of that class, and I turned and I started to talk, and I started to tremble, and I stammered. It was so embarrassing, and I could see the 30 students looking at me and the teacher. You know, and they were all looking at me, and girls that I liked, you know, were just like cringing. It was so, so bad and humiliating and embarrassing. And my best friend, too, I was trying to emulate in this attempt at doing a fast talking salesman for some reason. So I walked out of that classroom truly shaken, and I really didn't have too many people to talk to at that age. I didn't have that kind of relationship with my father where he would, you know, say, well, what's up, son? What happened? Not dad, I have a problem. I had to figure it out on my own. And I went out into the hallway. And within a couple of hours, I saw a poster that said that Dr. White was having an acting class. And I said, well, I've fallen off the horse. I'm going to get back on a higher horse. And I joined the acting class where I excelled.
Nice.
And I learned the art of the creative pause, the dramatic pause. Uh-huh. And I was suddenly in showbiz, high school showbiz. I was like,
so you found a spot for yourself. You found, okay, this is an identity, this is a
right.
group.
Yeah.
And you had, like, getting into something like that, you have an instant group of friends.
Yes.
So, like, you know, all these people that wind up taking a shot at the president or, you know, shooting up a school or something.
Yeah.
That's all people that don't have something like that.
Well, it's interesting because I was always part of the theater group, but always like backstage, like up in the catwalks, like adjusting the lighting, you know.
Right.
Guy changed the amber to magenta on
stagecraft.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And then suddenly I was cavorting on the stage, and I guess the bug bit me, and I happened to get a scholarship in theater.
To where?
Well, no, just it was an award from the school.
Oh, I see.
I think they invented it just for me.
Oh, okay, nice.
But it was still money that I used to go and visit a girlfriend in England. And
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, so how do you move back to Manhattan? How does that happen, or what time?
Well, the Vietnam War was winding down, but I was in the last
draft.
Lottery.
Oh, okay.
You know. And luckily, my number came up high, so I wasn't in contention. I wasn't called up. But my parents were so concerned that they wanted me to go to school in outside of the country. And if I went outside of the country, I was entitled to a UN scholarship.
Ah.
And so the nearest city was Montreal, so I went to McGill University for... where I majored in LSD. Yes, I got my LSD at McGill University.
Okay.
I didn't do well. I was supposed to be studying medicine. I was studying biology. I was really unfocused, and I really didn't know what I wanted to do. So when I went to university, I just chose my best subject in high school, which was biology, at least according to the girls there.
Okay.
And I failed miserably, and I couldn't go home. So I joined another acting school, Rick Perry's Actors Studio, where I did very well. Again, I'll always remember, you know, I kind of went in as a newbie, and I was so... treated with such hostility by the existing members of the class. I went up and I say, "Hi, I really enjoyed. I was sitting in on the class, and Renee, I thought you were terrific." They just sniff the air and walk away. And I just like, I said, "Oh, so it's going to be like that."
This was right? In New York?
No, this was in Montreal.
Oh, okay.
So I said, okay, so I had to bring something to the game. And I started going up there and I started killing it on stage because I had a... You know, I would watch everybody do the same thing over and over again, and Simon and I'd go up and do something completely, a left-hand turn.
Uh-huh.
Right? And of course, by that time, I was a master of that dramatic pause. Uh-huh. You know? And so, in a month, I had all of them eating out of my hand, and Rick Perry himself came up with his sunglasses and his cigarette, and he said, "You know what, Kai? I like the way you think." Right? And so, you know, and so I was doing little bits, you know, the actors in that school would be hired out as extras for any film project that was coming through at the time. But I'd still go down to New York every once in a while. When I would go down to New York, I'd go to Max's and I'd go to CBGB's. I saw the Ramones at CBGB's on a rainy night. There was 8 people there.
Yeah.
You know, and I saw Lydia Lunch over at, I saw the Teenage Jesus and the Jerks at Max's, and I came back to Montreal inspired. I mean, I loved that whole minimalist art scene that was going on. So I decided to start a band,
okay.
A la, you know, in the vein of Teenage Jesus and the Jerks, which didn't seem like you needed to have much musicianship skills.
The no-wave approach, sure.
It was more like you need to have the right attitude, presence, and it was taking the means of production, you know, wresting it away from
the, actual
the
musicians.
White pillars.
Right,
you know,
right, right.
You can do it.
Yes.
You know, just do it. And so I put together a band up there, like a band a week, like... 222s 1 week, and you know, the next week it'd be the Existors, and another week it'd be the Chromosomes, and you know, just like the same lineup, but it just kept changing, and it was just so much fun. And really, at that point, I was the kind of the lead singer.
Okay.
And I was playing a little bit of bass, but it was really just the same, you know, eighth notes pounded out on one string.
Uh-huh.
You know, but at that point, I was teaching myself some bass, or at least I had one, you know, within arm's reach.
Right.
When I moved down to New York eventually, and I met Tav, at a party. Katie Kay, the fashion designer, was having a party, and we sat at the table. Amy Gassner,
right?
Amy Stark was
right.
Was with him.
Okay,
and
this is like 78 or something. 79.
Yeah, I would say
there.
I would say 79.
Okay,
So this Tav and I struck up a friendship. Of course, he needed a place to stay on occasion.
Okay, sure.
And so I got into that. But I loved Tav. I still love him. I mean, he was such a colorful character. He's provided me with so much grist.
Sure. And I'm sure he was no less provocative character at that time, showing up in that scene, even amongst a sea of interesting people.
Actually, I met him personally in that kitchen. That was papered up because it was such a hot day. July 4th, and it was like 98 degrees, and there were asphalt puddles like around Manhattan. There was nobody in the street.
Uh-huh.
But I had seen Panther Burns at the Mud Club.
Okay.
And I really, really enjoyed the show. It was great. So I knew who he was, but uh-huh. now we were had befriended each other.
Right.
One thing led to another, and then he and Amy came over and were staying with me for a while, and he knew that I had a bass, and then, 6 months later, he was had this show at the Ratskeller and needed a bass player, and he called me up, and suddenly I was playing with him, and
okay.
Jimmy Rip.
Yeah.
Oh. I think Jimmy Rip was so disappointed.
he was the guitar player at that time.
He was the guitar player, and I was playing bass, and I really was kind of a complete, newbie to it. I don't know. I mean, I was hired more on my looks, I think, than my ability.
Okay. Well,
probably now.
Well, Panther Burns has always had a tradition of, nowadays they have a Cracker Jack band. Everybody's a good musician. Yeah. But for a long time, the part of the friction of that band was, some accomplished musicians playing primitive music with some less accomplished musicians, and the interaction between those.
Right. My job interview was like, well, can you operate a chainsaw?
Do you have some engineer boots? Can you ride a motorcycle? So at this time
he did get me on a motorcycle.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. So I was a member of that Panther Burns Motorcycle Club.
Oh, all right.
In the Charlie Feathers tradition.
Right? Right,
right. Right.
Well, up there in New York this time, you're an actor. Are you running into like other people? Like I saw this movie that Basquiat is in, and Tav has a scene at the very end where Tav is playing a drunk guy who's aggravating Basquiat at a bar.
Right, right.
But,
that's the Glenn O'Brien and Mary Paul produced film that was called what was it called? It's escaping me right now.
I saw it in the last 6 months. Yeah, I was like, wow, this is really fun. It's just to see New York and
New York beat or something.
New York, the city at that time. So that's the milieu that you're operating in. So so you were around all those Basquiat and all those.
Oh yeah. Well, I met Basquiat. I had a very close relationship with him. People do call me now. To this day, every once in a while, I get a phone call. Somebody wants me to authenticate something, which I can't do unless it was made. But I saw a lot of work created. Jean Michel lived with me for about 8 months.
Okay.
And then we were so friendly that he flew to Italy to go create some work in Modena for Emilio Mazzoli. And then after 3 days, he flew back and he knocked on my door and I said, what are you supposed to be? You're in Italy. I have nobody to talk to. So he came back and he took me, invited me and Suzanne Malouk to go with him. And so I went over there for 6 weeks and drank blood orange juice to my heart's content. And we had an amazing time. And I watched like 10 huge canvases being made. They had a hangar for him at the airport that they converted into a painting studio. And there were literally like six assistants there who were stretching the canvases and setting them up, you know, like enlarged canvases. I'm talking right. about like, you know, 8x12 canvases. Uh-huh. And I'd go over there and drop by every once in a while, and then we'd get together. and then at the end, when we were leaving, he had this bundle of cash. I mean, he had a lot of money that he had made from those canvases. Mm-hmm. And let's say it was $200,000. And the Italians don't like you taking money out of the country at the time.
Right.
So we went over to the airport, and we were racing back to get to the Milan airport. And I had to return the rent-a-car, and we were going to miss this TWA flight, you know, the try walking across
right,
airlines.
Sure, right? Yeah.
So I race over, drop off the rent-a-car. I come back, and I go inside to try and make it to the ticket counter, and I see Jean-Michel standing there in a paint-splattered Giorgio Armani jacket, you know, and jeans, and a fishing cap with dreadlocks coming out from underneath, right? And Suzanne Malouk, who was his Nico-esque pale beauty, you know, standing there with red lipstick, black hair, pale white, eyes just staring dolefully out. And on either side of them were two gendarmes with submachine guns. And then there was, what's his name? This Interpol agent,
uh-huh.
right, standing there in the trench coat, hands in his pockets, you know, like Peter
Columbo, yeah, Peter Falk.
No, more like Pink Panther. Right?
Oh, Peter Sellers.
Peter
yeah.
Sellers, you know, like
Inspector
like
Clouseau,
mustache, you know, and just kind of they were waiting for me, and Jean is kind of looking at me with a wan smile. He was smiling through the whole
yeah.
thing. At this point, he was a black man in America, and he, you know, this just
what are you going to do to me, right?
So. What I failed to disclose was he had given me $80,000, and he gave $80,000 to Suzanne, and then he had $80,000, and Suzanne took hers and stuck it into one of her black cowboy boots, uh-huh. and I took mine, and I thought, oh, I'll just put it in my vest pocket, you know,
uh-huh.
you know, hide it in plain sight,
right,
and. But now we were taken into the bowels of the airport, baggage claim. And I know we're not talking about music right now.
No, that's all right. No, we like this.
But we were taken over to the baggage claim area where they had these long aluminum tables where they would sort through things. And they took our baggage, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, Jean-Michel's baggage was an old television box, a cardboard box with a rope tied around it that was practically falling apart. And he just threw some clothes into the box. He took a beat box, you know, cassette player,
right.
and threw that in. And then there was just to make the salad a little spicier, there was like cassettes all over the place. Right? And then you just shake it up, and then, you know, so they pour that out on the table, and everything goes skittering across. I remember that we were listening to John Hassell and Brian Eno at that time as we were wandering through uh-huh. Italy with the beatbox.
Right.
Something called Chemistry. It was a great, great record.
Okay.
And... So then they start searching Suzanne, right? Mm-hmm. And they have her take off her boots, and boom, there comes like cash kind of skittering across the table. Whoops. Right? Whoops. So standing there, and they didn't find my money.
Yeah.
They didn't pat me down.
So how'd y'all ultimately get out of this thing, just
so,
to wrap it
so
up?
So the thing is, they see a black man with dreadlocks, with money, and what do we all think?
I think that he's a drug dealer, right?
Drugs.
Okay.
And it didn't help that he smelled of marijuana.
Uh-huh.
So we get separated and we get led down to the, into another part of the airport that few people ever see, right? And there's multiple chambers back there, and there were interview rooms, like interrogation right. rooms. And I got taken into one, he got taken into another, Suzanne went into another. And they were saying, well, where did you get the money? I said, well, Jean earned this. He's a painter. And they said, yeah, right. Mm-hmm. You know, I said, no, he's a painter, and he made 8 paintings. We were here for it. And, yeah, right, right, right. I said, well, you should call Emilio Mazzoli in Modena. Call him, and he will explain. And about 90 minutes later, we were all released.
Okay.
Right? So, and our plane was waiting for us still. And we got onto this TWA flight. Now, I always remember I was sitting in the back of the plane. There was like empty Coke cans rattling around. I said, oh, I'm home. I'm back, going back to America. Right? There was garbage in the aisles. Right. Thank God.
Man, oh, man. Now, at what point do the two of you meet? How do? Because now you guys have been playing in a band together. I love the new material you guys put out, most recent record, the Sad Electric Now. I love the
title. Electronic
Now.
The Sad Electronic Now. Sorry. Beautiful stuff. I love the way the band sounds. You guys sounded so terrific last night. How did you guys start playing together? And
well, we have a mutual friend. I was married to Deep Hop, and he had known Deep Hop for 30 years, and I didn't. I didn't know him. I never met him until I came back to take care of my dad, who was elderly. And Dee was always one of those guys who goes, I'm doing a gig. Come and play. Come and play. He was a great promoter.
Okay.
Always got people together to play. So then I said, well, you know, I need a bass player. And he said, well, how about Kai? And so I just started playing with him. And then COVID came along, and we just became COVID buddies. And we spent the next couple of years just he and I playing, or Dee and he and I playing on sidewalks in front mm-hmm. of art galleries and all, because mm-hmm. there was no inside music.
Right.
Mm. Dear Friends came over to my place in Brooklyn, place at the time, and she started playing her songs for me. And at that point, I was kind of had put down the bass for a while, but I was picking up a little. I was finding joy in playing again.
Uh-huh.
But I was very picky about who I would play with. You know, I just didn't want to play with some cover band. I mean, I wanted to play with a band that had some poetry behind it and some philosophy behind it.
Right.
And Dear France came in with her songs. She was so pretty. And we sat there and she started playing a song.
She is a goddess. She is a punk rock goddess.
She is. She's the authentic, genuine deal. She represents the New York underground so well.
Yes.
You know, but she started playing songs and I started kind of responding, and immediately there was some sort of natural give and take, which I continue to find great joy in even today, even last night. You know, there was something rare when that comes along, you know.
Yeah, no, it was a terrific gig last night. Everybody in the room was like, wow, this is the real deal, man. You could just feel it, so you hear it.
Right. That's why we need a booking agent.
right. Well, you know, we do have a lot of music professionals who listen to the Troubled Men podcast and the Feral Zone, so you never know whose fertile ears are going to, something's going to spark in their
Well, if there's a booking agent out there listening, I'll tell you, I have so much respect now for what you do. I love you, and please let me make you a nice cappuccino.
Well, I think we're kind of coming in on the downslope of the podcast here, but man, I'm so glad we got to do this. You know, you never know what's gonna fall right into your plate. You know, and as I was watching y'all last night, I was like, we got to do a podcast tomorrow. We got to do it, man. So appreciate y'all coming. Usually we do it under cover of darkness, but you know, I searched through my closet and found my cleanest dirty shirt for
looking fly
Sunday morning coming down here. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, dear France and Kai Eric. It's been so great seeing you again, Kai, and so great meeting you.
Yeah, it was a
dear.
Pleasure.
Right back
a
at pleasure. You, Renee. And this podcast is the real deal.
Oh, you know,
very nice, very impressive.
Oh well, you know, we're just chopping it up and finding cool people, and you know, as many interviews as people who come on the show have done, they haven't done this one, and they haven't done it from, you know, my point of view of what I think is interesting. So that's why I feel
well, you continue to be a great influence and inspiration.
Oh, God bless you, Kai. Well, all right, for Dear France and Kai Eric, I am Renee Coleman signing off from inside the Feral Zone. Good night.